in his well-known article, Rupture and Reconstruction, which appeared in 1994, Chaim Soloveitchik discusses the trend towards halachic strictness in contemporary orthodoxy. Professor Soloveitchik concludes his article in this fashion, quote, "I think it is safe to say that the perception of God as a daily natural force is no longer present to a significant degree in any sector of modern Jewry, even the most religious. Religious Jews seek to ground their new emerging spirituality less on a now unattainable intimacy with him than on an intimacy with his will. Having lost the touch of his presence, they now seek the solace of his yoke." God as a daily natural force is no longer present. A now unattainable intimacy. Lost his presence. Seek his yoke. These very resonant lines attest to something fundamental that is taking place inside of Judaism right now. Often, this move towards stringency, what we call chumrah, in almost all corners of orthodoxy, has been analyzed as a response to modernity, the onslaught of secularism, the perceived lackness of the reform or conservative movements. But Professor Soloveitchik suggests that there is a poignant theological reason for what many have called the slide to the right. Unable to feel God's presence, Orthodox Jews in the last number of years have turned to strictness in halakha, as if somehow, if there was just that much more fastidiousness to every single piece of halakhic minutiae, if every last detail of mitzvah observance were covered, if every last chumrah was invoked, then maybe, just maybe, the concealed God of Auschwitz, the hidden God of silence, would creep out and become revealed amidst our current darkness. Would toward it were, but it isn't that simple. The history of Judaism is a constant struggle with the goal of trying to experience God in daily life. But Dr. Soloveitchik is alluding to a now unattainable intimacy. He's inferring that such intimacy was more easily attainable in the past. And there are certainly special factors that make the quest for God particularly difficult in our day and age. And much of this assault on simple faith has been documented, well documented. And you all know the culprits, the effect of the Enlightenment, the subsequent turn towards moral relativism, the rise of modern science and technology as a replacement for faith, and, of course, the devastating impact of the Holocaust, and with it, doubt about the presence of God. It's hard to describe the kind of organic place that religion had in pre-modernity in the life of the ordinary Jew, where the presence of God was taken for granted, popularly captured in something like Fiddler on the Roof, based on the Shalom Aleichem story where Tevye the milkman speaks to God in ordinary folksy conversation with the clear assumption that God is real and present. What I want to think about with you here is the especially daunting task for those in search of God today. What is the best path to God? Can we even know that for certain? And does religion help us in this quest or actually hinder us in our attempt to forge this relationship? I would say that Tisha B'Av actually epitomizes this problem very well. We're told in many sources that the offering of korbanot was a crucial method not just of atoning for sin, but of creating this kind of communion with God, of feeling that closeness, and presumably the loss of the temple and that severed connection lies at the heart of the sadness that we're supposed to feel on Tisha B'Av. But The destruction took place 2 millennia ago and onwards. And the loss of the sacrificial system. And though we're supposed to mourn their loss and yearn for their return, by now, I imagine that many of us are actually quite ambivalent and even squirm at the very idea, do I really want to be slaughtering animals and calling that religion? We live in an age of computer screens and information highways, and secretly, we may not relish the return of the sprinkling of blood and the burning of limbs. Now, one could argue, I suppose, that we eat animals that have been slaughtered for our food with little hesitation. But perhaps we view such slaughter as part and parcel of our physical needs. But to kill animals for a spiritual intention seems somehow counterintuitive. Just because Jews used to do it, the argument might continue, does that mean we need to revive the practice in the vastly different cultural context of today? To that end, let's briefly review the argument of the Rambam and the Ramban about whether korbanot are intended by God, lichatchila, even prior to Israelite history. There's a famous and much discussed passage in 332 of the Guide of the Perplexed where Maimonides writes the following, quote, "A sudden transition from one opposite to another is impossible. Therefore, man, according to his nature, is not capable of abandoning suddenly all to which he was accustomed. At that time, the time of the Israelites, the way of life generally accepted and customary in the whole world, and the universal service upon which we were brought up consisted in offering various species of living beings, in the temples in which images were set up, in worshiping the latter and in burning incense before them. God's wisdom and God's gracious ruse, his trick, did not require that he give us a law prescribing the rejection, abandonment, and abolition of all these kinds of worship, for one could not then conceive the acceptance of such a law, considering the nature of man, which always likes that to which it is accustomed." At that time, this would have been similar to the appearance of a prophet today, who, calling upon the people to worship God, would say, "God has given you a law forbidding you to pray to him, to fast, to call upon him for help in misfortune. Your worship should consist solely in meditation, without any works at all. Therefore, God may be exalted, suffered the above-mentioned kinds of worship to remain, but transferred them from created or imaginary and unreal things to his own name may be exalted, commanding us to practice them with regard to him only." Through this divine ruse, it came about that the memory of idolatry was effaced, and that the grandest and true foundation of our belief, namely the existence and oneness of the deity, was firmly established. End quote. That this would be a controversial way to describe korbanot is not hard to see. In this depiction, God comes off as a bit of a wily character, perpetrating what Maimonides calls his gracious ruse. Korbanot are presented virtually as a concession to an ancient mentality that has become used to sacrificial worship since this was a staple of the pagan way of life. It would be impossible, according to Maimonides' historical reconstruction, for them to make the adjustment to a different kind of worship. It would be akin to someone today telling us that prayer is no longer allowed, shuls are superfluous. In the passage I just read, and at other times in the guide, Maimonides seems to allude to the idea of a potentially superior worship, a kind of progression up the ladder of the spirit from sacrifice at the bottom to prayer, but it doesn't stop there, to meditation, and in the end, to silence, to sheer intellectual contemplation. This progression is also chronological, meaning that it has succeeding historical stages. First comes the offering of animals, then the more refined but still relatively crude performance of prayer, then the subtler and more intellectual mode of meditation, and finally, silence. And just a side note, if you look in 159 of the guide, Maimonides quotes a number of prakim from Tehillim, and the source quotes are always about silence. Silence is better than words, commune with your heart and be still, alluding to this idea that ultimately some kind of connection to God transcends materiality, animals, and certainly transcends words. A little bit further on, in that passage we spoke about in 332 of the guide, Maimonides talks about two intentions of the Torah. It's really all the mitzvot come down to two things. And one is primary and one is secondary. And the primary goal is what he calls, quote, the apprehension of God, the focusing of all of our mental, emotional, spiritual energies towards God, the constant feeling that no matter what you're doing, walking, eating, talking, teaching, that you're standing in God's presence. That's basically the goal of Torah. The secondary intention of the law is to combat idolatrous practices wherever you find them. And he makes it clear that sacrifices pertain to that second intention, to combat idolatry, whereas with prayer, the goal is to come closer to the first intention, to get close to God. Now, all of us can see the problem here with rendering korbanot in this way. If they are an historically specific institution to be surpassed by better and later forms of worship, this opens the door wide open to a lot of questions. Here's two for a start. Number one, if sacrifices are historicized, what about all other mitzvot? Maybe they were good for their time, but no longer. Number two, what of the truth claims of other religions, such as Christianity, which specifically argues that while the Torah may have once been valid, it's been replaced and superseded by a superior form of religion, namely belief in Christ. So, criticism of the Maimonidean view, as you can well imagine, was not long in coming. Shortly thereafter, the Ramban, in his Perush on Chumash, if you look in Vayikra, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tet, chapter 1, verse 9 of Leviticus, heavily rebukes Maimonides for his words in the guide. He calls them nonsense, and says that they, quote, make the table of God despised, unquote. Indeed, Ramban, if we can borrow a poker term, sees Maimonides' history lesson and raises them by invoking even more ancient history when he says, quote, when Noah went out of the ark with his three sons, there were no Chaldeans or Egyptians in the world, yet he offered a sacrifice and it found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Ramban goes on to cite another example in the story of Cain and Hevel, even further back in biblical history. And we know that the two brothers offer sacrifices to God. And he cites Hevel's sacrifice as being pleasing to God. And he concludes this way, does the Ramban, quote, heaven forbid that there should be no benefit and no desired end from sacrifice, but only the denial of idolatry from the opinions of fools. Without getting into the more technical points of the Ramban's critique, his overarching message is quite bracing. The mitzvot are permanent in purpose and intent and remain the best path to God there is. Even Maimonides, as is well known, did not let his philosophical opinion get in the way of his faithful codification in the Mishnah Torah of all the sacrificial rites. So I've spent a little bit of time here on this problem of sacrifices to try and edge us a bit closer to what I see as a persistent quandary in modern Jewish life, which is what happens when you find that the performance of a mitzvah, rather than bringing you closer to God, seems to take you farther away. If the purpose of Torah is to remind us that we're always in the presence of God, then to use the example of Shabbat, will that longed-for closeness be achieved more by not ripping toilet paper or by driving to the zoo and seeing the wonders of nature? And I cite that example because it was one that was communicated to me by a Reform rabbi that I once engaged in discussion, who argued that sometimes the Torah seems the very antithesis of spirituality. And the rabbi continued that if the knowledge of God is the end game, then maybe a little less halachic fidelity would be a good thing. I argued, we didn't argue, it was a very friendly conversation. I thought the example that the rabbi gave was constructed around a faulty analogy. After all, if one is going to make a fair comparison, then why not compare the zoo outing to a long walk on Shabbat, unfettered by a ringing cell phone or traffic jams? But though the rabbi and I parted company on Hilchot Shabbat, this problem of Judaism paradoxically getting in the way of seeking God is a real problem. And it comes up quite persistently in our age, the age of autonomy, where people's first resort for moral reasoning is generally themselves, what I like to call their sense of things. However, as I noted before, once you start assessing mitzvot as out of date, then the slippery slope is pretty much obvious and endless. Korbanot are an easy target, but I don't see any reason why that line of thought should stop with sacrifices. You could say, why wear black boxes on your arms? Will that really get me to God? Why wave palm branches, blow ram's horns, why eat unleavened bread for a week, avoid certain foods? This devil's advocate argument can go on and on and on. And it's true, of course, that many books have been written throughout Jewish history supplying reasons for these mitzvot, but ultimately there is a recognition that we do them because this is the divine will. To put it a different way, we serve God in God's way and not ours. But what if serving God in God's way doesn't feel spiritual? Now, for the late Israeli philosopher Yeshaya Leibowitz, that was beside the point. His reason that we must serve God in God's way is quite ironic if the end goal is actually closeness to God, because Leibowitz, following in Maimonides' footsteps, sees God as utterly unknowable anyway. And hence, any attempt at spirituality which does not conform with halakha may feel good, may even be quite effective in giving you a feeling of dveikut with Hashem, but it's not a mitzvah, says Leibowitz, and it can't be called service of God, therefore. The implications of this are actually very radical. And they're actually very nicely summarized by his student, Dr. Ehud Ben-Nur. Dr. Ben-Nur, in opposition to the model of spiritual progression that I spoke about a moment ago, writes the following, quote, "The comparison of sacrifices to prayer and meditation does not necessarily imply that one practice supersedes another. The comparison can only imply supersession if we assume that it's possible for human beings to contemplate God. But if God is unknowable, if the divine essence is inconceivable, then the case for meditation will be just as difficult or even more difficult to defend because of the inescapable danger of worshiping in your mind an entity that is other than God. In other words, if we have no shot of understanding God anyway, then the notion of serving God through sacrifices or through meditation as superior to sacrifice, that's just a reflection of our own bias. Our analysis of what is spiritual and what is not, and I grant you, every fiber of my body and probably your body as well, may lean that way, may say clearly meditation seems more spiritual than animal sacrifice, but it isn't necessarily so. It's true that in the Torah passages we've read lately in Shul, leading up to this day, Haftarah passages from Yirmiyahu and Yeshaya, that there's a lot of criticism of bringing korbanot. God is narrated actually as having no use for korbanot, but the intent of the prophets, I think, is to tell us that sacrifice without social justice is a fairly empty gesture. I don't think that they mean to strip korbanot of their halachic centrality. You could ask, well, if you can't understand God, what's the point of a mitzvah anyway? What's the utility of trying to experience an unfathomable being? Those are good questions, and I frankly have no answers for you. One could say, of course, that Leibowitz is wrong and that God is fathomable, or you could argue a version of the medieval argument that doing a mitzvah is good for you, even if you don't know how and why. Similarly to taking medicine, which cures you even if you don't know what the medicine is composed of or actually how it works. And that was a very popular line of reasoning in the Middle Ages in Jewish philosophy, that a mitzvah affects your soul even if you have no clue how it does affect it. Nonetheless, I think that even if Judaism tells you to do a mitzvah because it's good for your soul, we tend to trust our feelings and experiences of these things rather than some kind of bald religious pronouncement. We want to feel a closeness to God and not just be told that somehow one day being religious will give you that experience if you hang in there long enough. So that's, to me, the great catch-22 of Jewish spirituality, is that halachic practices may feel repetitive and not uplifting, but they're divinely sanctioned. Non-halachic practices may inspire, may feel transformational, but they're autonomous, and hence for Leibowitz, not in and of themselves religiously relevant, or even Jewish. After all, let's be candid. Art, athletics, music, nature, philosophy, psychology, sex, travel, you can add whatever you like to that list. They may be very energizing and utterly life-altering, but they're domains that are independent of religion. They don't require the Torah for their existence. The obvious rejoinder to everything that I've been saying here is that Judaism contains many methods to heighten spirituality and come close to God, and that you don't need to search outside of the Torah for such fulfillment. So I have been told actually many times. There's prayer and Torah study. There's Musar, there's acts of Chesed, there's Chassidut, Kabbalah, there's the miracle of the land of Israel and the reclaimed state. There are books on Jewish meditation, there are Karbach Minyanim everywhere, and more. And there is no doubt that these are all powerful tools for spiritual growth. I do wonder, though, given all of these, we should be firing on all spiritual cylinders in our community, but we are not. Perhaps if you don't use them, you lose them. And given the inconsistent ways that these things are presently utilized, I have to return, and I remain actually quite steadfast in my conviction that much of this is somewhat peripheral for most people's religious struggle. To be plain, you can tell people about Musar and Kabbalah and Torah study and Karbach Minyanim, and they still feel a gap, a lack, an emptiness, a dislocation, a fragmentation. Something's not happening in my spiritual life. These things may relieve the symptoms from time to time, but they don't cure the patient. And I'll try and explain why this is so in a moment. So I'm afraid I brought us all full circle. The problem of bringing more God into my life in the 21st century very stubbornly remains. I think we need to understand the inherent difficulties in this quest, as well as what we can control and improve in our ability to find God. I want to start with what I see as the heart of the matter, what you might call an inherent structural problem in finding God. It's hard to find God because God is not there for us in the way anything else is. The philosopher Jacques Derrida, in a very insightful comment, notes, quote, "All signs are a sign of the fall." What this means is that in the Garden of Eden, Adam HaRishon feels God's presence directly. There are no intermediate steps, no signs or substitutions for God. Just pure God. It's almost unimaginable, unbelievable. Pure, unmediated, in a way that is practically inconceivable for us now. But after the fall and the expulsion from Eden, all we have are signs. Take a gravestone. A person has died. Someone you love. And we erect a sign, a physical trace of them. But it's a trace of them being gone. Even Torah is a kind of sign. In the absence of the God of Eden, we have a text. We have a scroll. We use signs to recover the presence of something to say that this is a representation of that. But the sign itself, the very fact that you have a sign, guarantees that the presence that it signifies is gone. Because if the presence was here, you wouldn't need the sign. We'd have the thing itself. In Eden, God is the thing itself. And after that, it's all signs. Really, the best illustration that I personally have ever seen for this idea is in a work of fiction from the 19th century, Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. In the novel, the main character, Heathcliff, has desperately attempted to erase the gap and fill the chasm between him and his soulmate, Catherine. Catherine has died several years before. To this end, Heathcliff is still hoping he can recapture her presence. He systematically, in the latter part of the novel, takes possession of everything in sight, literally buys up people and property, all because they remind him of Catherine. He's got a kind of quirky but intuitive logic. He thinks, if I can demolish everything in the way that is blocking me from her, if I can take it all away, there'll be nothing left but her, and I'll somehow get her back. But in the end, his efforts are tragically futile for reasons that he actually can articulate perfectly in this speech near the end of the text. Quote, what is not connected with her to me, and what does not recall her? I cannot look down to this floor, but her features are shaped on the flags, in every cloud, in every tree, filling the air at night. And caught by glimpses in every object by day, I am surrounded by her image. The most ordinary faces of men and women, my own features mock me with a resemblance. The entire world is a dreadful collection of memoranda that she did exist and that I have lost her. Although everything symbolizes and represents Catherine, it's the very fact of these things signifying her, substituting for her, being an image for her, that brings home so profoundly to him his devastating lack, the absence of her presence. Of his violent exertions to reconnect with her, he says ultimately, where is the use? The literary critic J. Hillis Miller summarizes this enormous irony. Each sign is both an avenue to the desired unity and also the barrier standing in the way of it. The sign gets you to God and at the very same time guarantees you won't get there. After Eden, after Sinai, everything in Jewish history is a salvage job. It's all a question of trying to recover something gone. Now, there are things that make it easier. You can choose your own preference. For me, feeling the inchoate power of the divine in some fearsomely beautiful stretch of Israeli desert always does it for me. And there are obviously things that make it much harder. If you watch piles of bones in the images first taken of the concentration camps after they were liberated. But all in all, it's a permanent problem, this recovery of God's presence. The attempt to get closer, always tenuous, very hard most of the time. So none of us can solve the fact of God's invisibility and the structural problem of finding a being utterly unlike ourselves. And it is pointless to try. What I would like to concentrate in the time remaining is on one factor that I feel we do have control over and which requires a revolution, in my view, a revolution which would greatly help us in our connection to God, and that is the role of the community. I mentioned that each person has had experiences or does certain things which help them to feel the presence of God. special places that you go to, music you listen to, certainly the birth of children, the recovery from illness. I mentioned earlier a number of tools that are intrinsically power, Kabbalah, meditation, intensity in prayer, Limud HaTorah. But what unifies all of these threads is that most often they are realized in private or individual situations. I've learned over the years that for me, speaking personally, the really missing piece and the one that would make a profound difference is how we as a Jewish community help one another to put God front and center. What should be an aid, a help in the quest for God, the power of the community to invigorate and renew your striving for the divine, can often turn out to be an impasse. If the community gets mired in all sorts of religious politics or name-calling, lack of communication, cold-hearted judgmentalism, and worse, a strange lack of love. It's been my feeling for a long time that we have to reconstruct the religious community we live in. I will try to explain and feel free to disagree. Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cook, the first chief rabbi of Palestine, one of the most creative thinkers in Jewish history, speculates that the essential difference between the First and Second Temple periods was a decline in the life of the collective and the rise of individualism and individual religious consciousness. He writes that during the Second Temple period, with the receding of the great universal light, the divine idea began to take on features of individuality. For Rav Cook, this is a spiritual reduction, a diminishment, a loss. He believes that the ultimate spiritual power for Jews lies in our collective strength as opposed to individual fulfillment. I see this as particularly significant in our day and age when there's an enormous amount of talking about individual fulfillment. And I'm as guilty as the next person, right? I grew up in the me generation where there was lots of talk about finding yourself and getting individual spiritual fulfillment. And I'm still an advocate of that, but I've come to see as I've gotten older that there are real limits to doing that in isolation. Although God can be found by each of us in various corners of our life, in bits and pieces of solitary searching, the real experience of revelation comes through what we're able to accomplish together. How are we doing on that scale in 2007? I'd like to raise 3 points in this regard, and I'd like you to think about them. Number one, do we as a community engage religion in a serious, broad, open, inspiring fashion? Are we afraid of ideas, or do we seek out forms of knowledge? Do we assign meaning to external shows of piety or even material wealth, or to internal states of being? Two, how do we in the Orthodox community, from laity to rabbinic leadership, relate to Jews of all kinds? Are we willing to engage other Jews religiously without necessarily trying to convert them to our sense of the truth? This applies both to other kinds of Orthodox Jews, as well as those who are not observant or affiliated with other movements. Three, do our schools and shuls inspire a sense of wonder about God, a feeling of curiosity and excitement about the religious domain? Point one. On May 9th, 1958, in an address in New York City, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said the following. It is customary to blame secular science and anti-religious philosophy for the eclipse of religion in modern society. It would be more honest to blame religion for its own defeats. Religion declined not because it was refuted, but because it became irrelevant, dull, oppressive, insipid. When faith is completely replaced by creed, worship by discipline, love by habit, when the crisis of today is ignored because of the splendor of the past, when faith becomes an heirloom rather than a living fountain, when religion speaks only in the name of authority rather than with the voice of compassion, its message becomes meaningless. Religion is an answer to ultimate questions, The moment we become oblivious to ultimate questions, religion becomes irrelevant and its crisis sets in. End quote. 50 years have passed, nearly. For me, Heschel's words are as true now as they were then. We do some very fine things as a community. We have lots of chesed and lots of Torah learning, lots of Israel action committees, and very committed parents and teachers. But we often lose sight of ultimate questions. One would think that Orthodox communities, to name the community I know best, would be doing their utmost to make recovery of God's presence a top priority. One would think that silence and sacredness in worship and a premium placed on self-examination and a serious engagement with ideas and a vision of wholeness and an embracing of God's world and all of God's creatures, and above all, one would think an atmosphere of love and tolerance between Jews of all stripes would imbue Jewish religious practice. We get it in pockets, but overall it often reluctantly seems to be the case that much of what we presently say and do unfortunately thwarts that goal. Real growth is painful. It requires thinking about views that are even anathema to oneself. But in the quest for truth, you got to be able to at least talk civilly and listen civilly. As though to anticipate, Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins listen to what Rav Kook writes in his essay, The Pangs of Cleansing, about the search for truth and God. All the troubles of the world, especially the spiritual, such as grief, impatience, disillusionment, despair, the truly basic troubles of man, they come about only because of the failure to view clearly the majesty of God. God's being is conceived by the multitude, and even by the individuals who would be their leaders, is that of a ruthless power from whom there is no escape and to whom we must necessarily be subservient. The tendency to see the divine essence is embodied in words and in letters alone is a source of embarrassment to humanity. Atheism arises as a pained outcry to liberate man from this narrow and alien pit, to raise him from the darkness of focusing on letters and expressions to the light of thought and feeling. Finally, to place his primary focus on the realm of morals. Atheism has a temporary legitimacy. It is needed to purge away the aberrations that attach themselves to religious faith, to uproot the dross that separates man from the divine light. And in the ruins wrought by atheism will the higher knowledge of God erect her temple. Out of the clash of these two opposites will mankind be aided greatly to reach an enlightened knowledge of God, which will bring near its temporal and eternal happiness. Whoever recognizes the essence of atheism from this perspective, embraces the positive element in it, and traces back its origin to holiness. End quote. That was Rev Cook's position regarding reality. All things, everything has its place. All things contain holiness. We don't embrace all things because many of those things have gotten derailed or have not achieved their potential. But we see them as part of the mosaic. All ideas can teach us something. This is how God is found, argues Rav Kook. One is commanded to keep mitzvot and maintain oneself as a proper Jew, But the quest for God requires a deep understanding of all of the interlocking facets of reality. Cut off the various nooks and crannies of knowledge, and the road to God becomes just that much more difficult. And that typified Rav Kook's relationship to all Jews of all kinds, referring back to my second point. How do we relate to not only non-observant Jews, but non-observant Judaisms, non-Orthodox Judaisms? To rabbis and to people who do not accept or follow the Orthodox view in various matters. There are many Orthodox Jews that I have met who maintain a position that there should be no religious dialogue or communication with non-Orthodox rabbis and movements. They would say, we possess the truth, they are heretics, or at best, ignoramuses, and there can be no bridging of that gap. So goes the argument. I emphatically disagree. I believe that we as a community need to begin to speak to each other, and not just about Israel and the Holocaust, but about primary matters of religion. And publicly. We can disagree, we will disagree, but we need to do it respectfully. We need to show that although we do not share the other's point of view, they are still part of Knesset Yisrael, and we need each other to be complete. We cannot talk about the destruction of the temples, the loss of God, the Sinat Chinam, and all the rest, and then in all good equanimity, cut ourselves off from Jews who do not share our views. After all, as Eliezer Berkowitz once commented, although Orthodoxy maintains halacha as divine, quote, it is still, after all, a personal belief. No matter how convincing our reasons or our proofs for the faith may be for us, they still will be no more than reasons and proofs for us. Now, truth be told, we don't need to point to non-Orthodox Judaism at the point where communication breaks down. We do the same thing inside of Orthodoxy. Soon there'll be no one left to talk to at all. The following is from a letter that I wrote to an Orthodox rabbi. I won't say when, who, or where, and don't bother to ask me. I'll quote a brief part. Fear, and thus rejection, of all views that are not in accordance with one's way seems to be very much in vogue these days in religious Judaism. But is it the best way? As I am sure you are aware, the Maharal, at the end of Be'er HaGolah, sees such a trend as utterly destructive and not in keeping with the Torah Derech, as he notes, quote, one who causes his opponent to hold his peace and refrain from speaking thus demonstrates the weakness of his own religious position. Curbing the words of an opponent in religious matters is nothing but the curbing and enfeebling of religion. End quote. How striking that Maharal writes this of those who oppose religion. How then can we in the Orthodox world defend such a tactic with our Orthodox co-religionists? You and I both know that criticism of the secular world is not such a difficult task. There is much there that is toxic and empty, and many great modern minds have eloquently dismissed the destructiveness of secular life. So it is not hard for us to address our secular brothers and sisters and confront them with the need to face up to the truth, to live for meaning, to embrace eternal values, and so on. It is more difficult, is it not? But equally important, to be able to examine our own Orthodox house and employ the same standards of honesty and intellectual integrity when it comes to how we model Judaism. How can we look at secular Jews in the eye when we are unwilling to dialogue amongst ourselves? End quote. Although the rabbi wrote me back, there was no response to this part of the letter. My last point was about shuls and schools. Finding God does not occur ex nihilo. You don't get something from nothing. It is an art that we need to cultivate in our children when they are young and in our congregants on a constant basis. You know, we have actual letters from the Second Temple period that convey the kind of feeling that the temple evoked. One such letter remarks, that one who sees the temple and its priests, quote, will come to astonishment and indescribable wonder and will be stirred by the holy quality which pertains to every detail. Our shuls are called Mikdash Me'at, a mini temple. Do they create a miniature version of that experience? Is finding God a priority in our educational system? Does the priority of feeling dvekut, of clinging to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, influence the curriculum of our schools? Do our teachers communicate that this is an important value? Does the tefillah that takes place in our schools teach our children the intense value of connecting to Hashem? Each person here can answer these questions in your own way. I would like to briefly cite a recent study done by Professor Moshe Sokolow, who teaches Bible and Jewish education at Yeshiva University. In an article entitled Teaching Spirituality in Day Schools and Yeshiva High Schools, Dr. Sokolow reviewed the mission statements of a sample of New York schools. He also reviewed the mission statement of one school in Toronto. I'll leave you to read the article to find out which one. Many of the statements skirted around the word spirituality. You won't find it in the mission statements of schools. However, to be fair, there were numerous mentions of halakha, of learning Torah, developing the whole child, recognizing God. So maybe you could argue these are sort of back-end ways of evoking the same idea. But the curriculum was not organized around dvekut in almost any way. It was organized around information, teaching kids what they need to know about Rashi, what they need to know about Gemara, and of course what they need to know about secular subjects. The conclusion, it's inescapable, is that we're creating an informed generation of Jews, but not necessarily ones that recognize the God quest at the center of a Jew's mission. I'm going to close. I've suggested here some of the factors that I think are instrumental for our community to place God at the center. Obviously, each individual Jew has to continue that quest privately as well. It's remarkable to consider how little small things can be so helpful. I ran across the following. It's written by Rabbi Ed Feinstein, who's got a large conservative congregation out in California. He wrote this, quote, "We North Americans are insane. 11 p.m. every night, we snuggle up ready for bed, and what's the last thing we do? We switch on the evening news. 30 minutes of murder, brutality, corruption, catastrophe, moral lunacy, sports and weather, and then it's good night. And then, in the morning, we're awakened by the clock radio set to some news station, and we begin the day with murder, brutality, corruption, catastrophe, moral lunacy, sports and weather. And you want to know why we're depressed? Mitzvah is not about habit. It's not about drudgery. Mitzvah is a reminder that we're alive for a very short time, and we have an opportunity to seek out the highest. So for 2 minutes, at the end of the day, just 2 minutes, we can click off the television, internet, telephone, rush of appointments, loud noises, world that we live in, and we can turn towards God. And we can close our eyes, and we can say Shema. And we can say Shema slowly and luxuriously every night. And we can do rise in the morning and do the same thing. And we can be mindful of who we love and how we're going to talk today. And we actually do have the time. We just need the will. There's a poem I always liked by Robert Frost in one of his early collections called Mending Wall. And in the opening lines of the poem, he writes, "Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. With the wall up, people are isolated from one another. With the wall down, even two can pass together through the gap." And Frost's meaning is unmistakable. Tisha B'Av is about nothing if it's not about walls. The Gemara tells us that the Second Temple was destroyed because of groundless hatred. In other words, when the walls of our hearts went up, the walls of the temple came crashing down. Jews seem singularly remarkable for our criticisms of each other. We seem to focus a lot on what the other person has done wrong and not what we can do to help one another. So 2,000 years later, we're still reeling from the loss of God, and it seems that if we use reverse logic, it seems fair to say that when our walls to each other come down, the walls containing God's presence will be rebuilt. It is difficult to find God alone. It is possible and preferable to find God together. May it be His will to bring Mashiach, b'mehera b'yameinu.
I want to thank all the speakers, all of you who have stayed, for the day who are here at the end. But I just want to say, Elliot is now going to be heading the education program at York University. I don't know if everybody knows that. And I think we're very lucky to have him having a great influence on our future teachers in our city. He's walking out, but I'm not going to let him. Tell him he should stay. And what he's articulating also is really the vision that we're trying, to do. I don't really want to put a plug, so to speak, but this is really what he articulated, I think, without saying so, is our vision in at Torah in Motion. We don't always agree on everything. Me and Elliot in our discussions, we don't agree on everything, but the way he projected it and how we have to talk and building a community, this is what we stand for, and I hope all of us in the room all stand for, and let us all work together to try and bring down the barriers and to try to take the walls down from our hearts so we can build the walls that the return of the divine presence of the Shekhinah. So I really want to encourage all of you to get involved in our community. And really, I think a lot of the things that El Ace was saying that we would like to do, I think it's important to say sometimes we feel that we don't have a community who supports some of the initiatives he was alluding to. And in the climate that we live in, it's very important that those who believe in what they believe in, they stand up and make their voices be heard and give people encouragement who do that. Hamevin Yavin. And with that, we'll wish that next year, which is intended to be the 20th year of this program, we should have in Yerushalayim Habniyah, whether physical, spiritual, but we should all grow. It should be a year of growth for all of us, and that we can celebrate Tisha B'Av and grow together as a community. Thank you.